And we have the pleasure to have Rory Heim, who came from the Netherlands to do the lecture. And just to give a brief introduction on him, he is a practicing architect working in design, research, broadcasting, building. He graduated from RMIT University in Melbourne, and he is a PhD there as well regarding emerging models of practice enabled by new technologies. He's an editor, broadcaster, writer, architect, and covers a wide range of subjects and interests. He's based in Amsterdam since 2009, and has worked with Volume Magazine, Almanac, MVRDV, DNA, AI, and others. And he's here to present his book, Future Practice. And without any further ado, please welcome Rory Heim.
Thanks very much to ArtSoc for inviting me, and especially thanks to Julian and Earl for coordinating it, and the students, and particularly Paul for his reaching out in the first place, and to Alan Jones, of course. Now, I'm going to talk about future practice. It's a kind of lecture of other people's work, which I feel funnel into this theme of where architecture is going. Is the sound okay, or does it sound weird?
Yeah,
it's good?
Yeah, it's very good.
Okay. I'm getting a strange echo. It's fine for me. It's a kind of narrative through the changing position of the architect up to where we are today, perhaps, and then a kind of speculation into possible directions that we could pursue in order to revive or regenerate the position of the architect. The kind of big story for me is, you know, how do we get it back in the big game of economy, of strategy, of large-scale thinking, and sort of become the people who have the answers like we used to be. So I'll kick in. This is my kind of crisis collage. It's an evolving collection of things going wrong in the world. I would suggest that that's become the kind of defining context, a sort of new state of normal rather than an exception. They're all real. The banana crisis was one that hit Australia, where I'm from, and curiously, people, when the price of bananas skyrocketed, people bought more bananas because it was this kind of, we need to have bananas, you know. So that's something perhaps that architecture can solve. And that's the point. All of these crises have a spatial consequence, and it's something I think we need to engage with in a more direct way. But meanwhile, architecture is having a kind of crisis of relevance. We complain of marginalization from the process of real decision making, of being treated like cake decorators, only interested in styling, undervalued financially, overregulated, too exposed to the instability of the market, as the latest economic crisis has proven, and many more. This is a real crisis. This is a kind of snapshot I did a few weeks ago. A cover of the London Evening Standard with this guy who can only get menial jobs with his architecture degree. The New York Times tells us to go to college but not to major in architecture. Pretty direct advice. This is the number of architects claiming unemployment benefits over the last 10 years. And, yeah, CNN, etc. This is the kind of view from the ground compared to the view from the news. This is a T-shirt that Arcus made during the last crisis, so in the early 90s, and it feels like it sums up a lot of sentiment that I see around architecture schools. And it's not just the students. This is David Chipperfield. He feels more and more impotent in doing real things and having an effect, which is, you know, curious for someone who's created a career out of making architectural effects. So this is another interesting portrait of the contemporary profession. Ola Sheeran, former partner of OMA, co-architect on the CCTV building in Beijing. This is, he was invited to co-edit the issue of Wallpaper last month. And this is a self-portrait that he commissioned from a Chinese artist. This is our hero in the center, surrounded by his chaos of his office. Everyone seems to be wearing either pajamas or prison uniforms. The cities they're designing are sort of heaped among the rubbish of the office. Some of them are on medical drips. You can see this is one here. There's another one standing there. Yeah, the pajamas is maybe refers to the fact that they've been there all night, and the prison reference perhaps that they're not allowed to leave, or they can't, or they don't feel obliged to. So this is a sort of, and this is from one of our stars, a kind of reflection of where we're at perhaps. We used to be at the centre of the action. So this is a Berlage's plan Zoud. For Amsterdam, which is where I've been living, and been lucky enough to live in some of these buildings, which he's sketched out. A kind of, you know, without wanting to be too nostalgic, this was a time when an architect could do a city and balance the political forces with the economic forces, with the social forces, and into something which is what I would describe as a generous inheritance on a city. These areas are really desirable still. They have schools, they have parks, they have, you know, open space, they have quality architecture that's meaningful. And it's something that we've... This is, I'm not saying that we need to recreate it in this way, but a society who can build two statues like this, these form part of the plan Zhao. On the left, a woman... teaching, passing down her knowledge to a girl on peace, I believe. There's a peace dove there and flowers. The kind of social cliches are relevant to the day. And the man is teaching the boy about industry and engineering. So it's kind of quaint, but also it speaks of a society that could, with a straight face, claim to think into the future about the next generation. And meanwhile, when we were called upon to give the answers, this is what we delivered, Korb's sweeping hand of the Ville Ready Youth. And this is how it manifests in the post-war, when society came looking for the answers, or looking to us for the answers. The Bijlmer, which is adjacent to Berlage's plan Zhao, is this Corbusian-style high-rise towers within the green field. Except as is so common with so many of these developments all over the world, it's been plagued by social conflict, poverty, crime, everything. It's Holland's Pruitt ego, and I'm sure Ireland has an equivalent. So our ambitions were popped. The moment when architects had the greatest power and were looked to to have the solutions for society, our decisions were so misguided and have led to such issues that I feel that we've lost the ambition to make grand schemes again. Could we ever be trusted, and why would we be after this? This is a plane crashed into the Bijlmer in 1970, and although it's not a result of this decay, it came to be a symbol of this socially problematic area, and just was another reason for people to move out and to leave it to the incoming refugees. So Wouter van Stiphout, who's my kind of go-to man on Dutch history and design and politics, asks, can we blame the architect? Can we just, is architecture, can we blame it for at least part of the poverty, alienation, frustration, aggression and crime that occurs in these post-war housing estates. And perhaps it's not important who we blame, but there will be no trial. But it's important, I think, philosophically for us to confront it. If architecture can, on the one hand, claim to solve problems, then it's only logical that it also can be blamed. And if it can be blamed, then if it can't be blamed, then it also can't be thanked. So I think if we claim to make social transformation, we also need to be prepared to take responsibility. Now, following this, this is a kind of history light. It's a manipulated history. I'm saying there's been three forms of retreat from social relevance. The first is the retreat into the avant-garde, the kind of safety of the abstract, the safety of the speculative, where it doesn't need to hit the ground in a meaningful way. The second retreat has been commerce, so to surrender our ambition, to surrender our own vision, and to blindly deliver what the developer asks. This is Dubai, a sort of direct manifestation of the architect in complete complicity with the demands of the market. This is another view from the ground, another shot of shoulders. This is Clive. I don't know if you can read it. He's got his phone number there. He has experience, 27 months experience on mega projects. That's his one-line CV looking for, and he's walking around the Dubai cityscape, which is the kind of trade fair for mega projects. He's looking downfallen, poor Clive. And then the third retreat, I would say, is into icons. So this idea, you know, we, on the one hand, deliver commerce, and on the other hand, we deliver pure image. And this is probably the apotheosis of that logic, a project that I'm not proud to have worked on, MVRDV's cloud, which created so much unnecessary controversy for its association with the Twin Towers. And then, meanwhile, the popular response has been to get busy, to kind of, dig the soil in our gardens. And I would say, you know, this is terrific. There's a huge amount of resourcefulness. There's a huge amount of enthusiasm. The public are interested. But meanwhile, at the point when we're facing our greatest challenge, I would say our response has been its most polite. So this is the kind of condition. This is the shrinking iceberg map of the architectural office here in the centre. And meanwhile, more enterprising disciplines are encroaching on our sovereign territory. And I think rather than seeing this pessimistically, we should see this optimistically. So we should be looking at where there is growth, where there's interesting ways of approaching the physical environment and borrowing techniques, borrowing tactics and incorporating them into our own practices. So that's kind of where the book comes in. And what the approach that I've taken is to try and articulate some new roles which the architect might occupy. They are not sort of exclusive jobs, they're not new disciplines, they're not new career paths, but they might be a role that you adopt for one particular project, or a role that you can look at and learn from or collaborate with. So it's a sort of pluralist perspective on paths forward. And each of those are told through interviews with people who I think are really on the ground, really executing that kind of work in the real world today. So this word future in the title is used in the William Gibson sense of the word, in that it's a future that exists but is not evenly distributed. The mainstream is kind of it's going to take time for the mainstream to catch up, but I think we need to set some points out in space where we can shuffle towards. Now, Dan Hill, who contributed the preface to the book, sees this edge of architecture, which is in the title, as a edge between, you know, architecture as it's traditionally defined and the stuff that's beyond, and divides the contributors along those lines. So we have non-architecture out here, we have an artist, we have a former graphic designer slash thinker. Marcus comes from a events background and is now interested in policy. Matt Webb makes digital products. Camilla is a graphic designer who's doing urban activism, and I could go on. These guys are more traditional, or at least they have practices which they describe as architecture. And then there's some people who can really go either way. Now, I'm going to talk about five, practices or projects that I can pull out of the book, and they kind of align with these big themes which I mentioned at the start. So, first up, in terms of, and I would say that these are the areas where we need to perhaps not fully embody, but at least know enough about to have an informed conversation. So, and this is one of the discussions that came up last night at PS Squared, that, you know, if we can at least meet some of these disciplines halfway, then we can have some agency in shaping the direction that a project might have, or using these as a way to inform or gain some power in the conversation. So first up, Indy Yoha, London-based practice called Zero Zero. I'm calling the civic entrepreneur. His terrific book, Compendium for the Civic Economy, does a similar thing to this in that it pulls together a whole series of case studies around what he describes as the civic economy, which is a sort of local-based institutions directed to a civic purpose. This is a project they're working on at the moment, which I think is fantastic. It's called the Scale-Free School, and it tries to assemble all the elements required of a school, so a primary school, from buildings and facilities which exist currently within a neighbourhood. So the public library becomes the school library, the a local cafe, they get vouchers to get their lunches there. Cinemas become lecture halls, the park becomes their sports grounds, etc. And all that is integrated with mobiles, so the format can become flexible. If a room changes, if they get an alert, they get an update, student cards, uniforms which create the identity, buses, minibuses, bikes, etc. So it's this idea that you can, with very little capital outlay, you can create a school just with the pieces that you have lying around. And I think that's, on the one hand, enabled by new technologies such as the Wi-Fi or the mobiles which integrate the whole thing. And it's a sort of, clever and generous way to think about how architecture can be embedded within a context. So perhaps the scenario is your approach to do a new school, and instead of beginning by drawing a plan, you research what else is out there and see how that money could be spent in a more intelligent way and to make use of the things that are out there already. The other project which I find a really inspiring precedent is called the Finchley Development Trust, which Zero Zero consulted on. And the story, as Indy tells it, is these... this local or this community in the south of Scotland were approached by an energy company who wanted to build an array of wind turbines on their hill adjacent to their town. And the normal response in my experience is to sharpen the pitchforks and fight these evil capitalists from destroying our hill. But instead, these enlightened townsfolk saw it as an opportunity. They're also interested in sustainability. They're interested in clean energy. They thought that the windmills were not such an ugly thing after all, and formed an energy cooperative and have purchased an extra wind turbine, which is then managed by the company. So it's their turbine. The money that is generated from it, or the energy that's generated from it, is returned to the town. They've used the revenue to increase the sustainable envelopes of their houses, and also to build some new facilities, such as a town hall, and improve the sports hall. And of 900 people in the town, I think 600 people are active and paid up members of this cooperative. Which is also the reason why they now need a town hall. I think this process of coming together and meeting has also reinforced the community spirit. And this is them signing their names on their own turbine, which I think is quite cool. And it's a great example of how, you know, to come back to this, I'm not going to keep shouting about how pointless community gardens are. There is a point to them. But this is, a great counterexample to show where, you know, that community scale approach can be applied to the real scale of economy and energy. Now, Jeannie Gang of the Chicago-based practice Studio Gang, I would describe as a professional generalist, particularly with this one project to do with the canals and the issue of species evasion around Chicago. So this is a photo of from 1914, cutting a new canal called the Calumet Feeder from Chicago into the Mississippi. So Chicago had this problem with its sewage, which wasn't being drained elsewhere. It was just sitting around in the Great Lakes, and at points it would catch on fire. It was this kind of burning turd pile. It was very poor for morale. So they had the great concept of dumping it all into the Mississippi, which must have seemed like a terrific idea at the time. Someone else's problem, it all goes downstream. In the spirit of Burnham, make no little plans. Let's really deal with this sewage. So this is the before picture. This is the watershed that separates the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. These are these new canals which they forged in across the watershed, thereby uniting the two. And this is the contemporary dilemma. Asian carp, which are invasive species, have moved their whole way up to Chicago. They've been deterred by electric underwater fences and charging of the water and various other attempts to stop their encroaching on the Great Lakes. Some people say they're already there. Fishermen have caught a few. They're incredibly destructive on the ecosystems. And if they get into the Great Lakes, it's a billion-dollar problem for the industry. So there's a lot of effort being made to stop that. And Jeannie Gang, as an architect, has come into this very conflicted, very layered, very complex issue involving, you know, all sorts of layers and a national scale of ecology, and just describes herself as a translator or an integrator. So she's selected different people to get around the table, ranging from somebody from the military who have security jurisdiction over the waterways, ecologists, you know, landscape urbanists, developers who are thinking about new neighbourhoods to try and fund some sort of project. And this is what they've come up with. So by taking these diverse inputs, filtering them through the ability of an architect to synthesise and make decisions and return with a proposal, she's proposed a new neighbourhood of Chicago, which is a wetland which will encourage particular species which can then deter the onslaught of the Asian carp, while also providing new opportunities for, you know, living. So in contrast to this Burnham, I would say this is also not making little plans, but it's making informed plans. So instead of this singular industrial vision of one problem, sewerage, one answer, canal. This is a still large scale, still visionary, but it's informed by so many different voices that it's ecological in that sense and hopefully more successful. And unlike the modernist failures we've seen earlier. Next up, I'm just going to take a quick slurp. Excuse me. Marcus Westbury, as I mentioned, has a background in hosting arts festivals, so youth arts festivals. He's a native of Newcastle, which is in Australia, not the one in UK. But I've been told has a similar predicament. It's been hollowed out by a declining industry. It's been its retail has been hollowed out by big box stores on the periphery. And this street, which is Hunter Street Mall, the sort of heart of the city, now looks more like this. And that, apparently that's lunchtime bustle. Most of the buildings are either boarded up or and have since been torched. There's nothing, there's no people, there's no business, there's no, and it's a sort of dangerous place to go. Marcus, who cares about the city and has experience in negotiating different ideas, but is also good at doing things on a shoelace. He went in there and talked to the building owners. You know, why don't you have any tenants? What's the issue? Why is this street so impoverished? And they're on the one hand holding out for a big paying tenant, and so they won't let it to anybody for cheap. But nobody's willing to pay that because it's such a terrible thing. So you're stuck in this cycle. He saw an opportunity to... He saw, on the one hand, all these empty spaces in the centre of town. On the other hand, all these creative people making brilliant work in their own living rooms. And thought, well, if we can bring these two ideas together somehow, what would be the kind of... Last night we were talking about a ninja move, like a one-inch punch which can unravel the whole complexity. He went in and designed a new tenancy agreement, which was based on a short-term rolling lease. So if somebody came along and wanted to lease it out as a real shop, then they could take it. But effectively allowed these creatives to occupy these spaces, fix them up. So this is a before and after. This is the smashed-in shop front. These are the owners. And now it's a record store. So they didn't have to do much, but they're there. And they've done dozens, I think 40 or 50 of these projects. The other thing that Marcus did was set up a not-for-profit, which acts as an intermediary. So they take on a lot of the burden of insurance and deposit. The creatives pay a nominal, very low amount of rent just as a kind of show of faith, and it makes it more real. I think half of them have been able to transition into fully operated, functioning businesses, and the other half, and anyway, this is a kind of general map, and this is what it looks like now on Saturday. I've been told Marcus has shown this picture to Newcastle locals, and they say, they either say that's not Hunter Street, or they say that's Photoshop. that you've just stripped those people in, and it's impossible. The other side of the story, which I really like, is that throughout all of this, Marcus was never contacted by the local council or the planning agency. They'd recently spent $10 million renovating the plaza. So they'd employed architects to say... how would you fix this place? And they'd say, well, we need new paving, we need new seats, we need new street trees, we need to make it nice on a physical, visual level, which of course did absolutely nothing and just cost millions of dollars. So this one strategic move, which cost nothing, he funded it his time on his credit card and borrowed some legal advice from a friend, has turned the whole thing around. And now, of course, he's consulting all over Australia. There's, I think, five or six of these going, these same ideas going in different cities, and also consulting overseas with the, just with the simple strategic move. And I think it's a great example of a non-architectural strategy that results in architecture, you know, a successful urban space, which of course is the Cedric Price maneuver. We all know that story. I love it. I love it because it makes it shows the sort of stupidity of architects. This is another Australian example. Apologies. Is my hero, this guy, Robin Boyd. This is him here. He died in 1971. He was our kind of modernist hero from the 50s and 60s. Died too young, never really developed or built anything of substance, but left an incredible mark as a cultural critic and as a... as somebody who had a vision for where Australia could be and who cared about it in a similar way to Marcus. He was, on the one hand, a really great architect. This is his house for the furniture designer, Featherston, which they said, we want to live in a garden, so that each of the rooms are just a different platform within a big greenhouse. And this is in 59, really radical, amazing stuff. He managed to cultivate an international network at a time when it took five hops to go from Australia to Europe. This is him giving a tour of Gropius around Melbourne, and was a fearless cultural critic. So this is his bestseller in Australia. It sold 200,000 copies. It transcended architecture. It was a you know, public hit, and it was basically talking about how ugly the Australian suburbs were, which is a surprising thing to be popular. You know, chopping off the trees, power lines everywhere, attaching unrelated ornament onto the front of houses. I mean, it's the same story all over the world. He thought it was particularly bad in Australia. And instead of just complaining, he went on and did something about it. So this is what he set up, this what was called the Small Home Service, where he was sponsored by the local newspaper, The Age. He had a weekly column and a small office of draftspeople. So he would sketch out a house, and each week they would design a new house and document it very simply. So, I mean, this is the 60s, so you could really document a whole house on two A1 sheets, not like today. Each week then he would write about it, describe the house in the newspaper, and then people could come to the small homes office and buy that set of plans, which they could give directly to a builder. It had a huge impact. 50,000 homes were built directly from these plans, and then it's estimated another 150,000 were directly influenced by it. So that's when somebody says, can you do this but add another room, or you know, a builder just does a multiple. 40% of new homes at the time in Victoria were built using this system. So from the cultural critique to actually being instrumental in turning it around, and now Melbourne has this incredible, again, a generous inheritance of terrific modernist buildings, and this kickstarted the careers of some of the other really great young architects as well, and continued for a number of decades. Large scale. Urban activist Camilla Bustamante, who I came across, she was studying her master's in Amsterdam. She studied graphic design there, and she comes from Peru, from Lima, where there is a in the 80s it was proposed a new metro network across the whole city. And the whole process got clogged in corruption, and the money went missing, and the government changed, and they only built 5 kilometres of track and 2 stops. And the train just goes back and forth once a week for maintenance reasons, and it is a kind of cruel reminder of what was promised. her response to this was to, well, she was first of all surprised to discover the entire plan. She'd never heard of it. She never knew that there was a big plan for Lima's Metro. And then went and discovered that there, there was all these stations planned. They all had names. And then worked out how long it would take them to finish this based on the current rate of construction, which has been on and off for a number of decades. So the project is called Lima Metro 2400. The metro is coming. So at the current rate, by the time they get to the airport, will be in 400 years. And each station then is given a number, the year of completion. And she went around the city putting up fake signs and talking to people and distributing metro maps and telling people, yeah, this will be in your neighbourhood in 200 years. So, aren't you lucky? Yeah. And she's very sort of bashful about it. The interesting other layers which I discovered later is that the Prime Minister who proposed this in the 80s is now back in power, and so it's been a way of making him accountable for his announcements in the past. It was sort of front page news, these maps and her stickers. She fled the country. She said she got a lot of people when she was putting out the stickers saying, you really better be careful, you don't want to annoy this guy. So she went back to Amsterdam to kind of for her own sake. Since then, she's been back and kind of welcomed, and she's been on all these talk shows, and it became a real thing, and lots of other independent campaigns to build the metro. The other thing I should say is that in Lima, it's a social justice issue. So the city is very segregated in terms of wealth and class. And people can spend up to 40% of their income just on commuting to do the low-paid jobs in the centre. So, it's more than just a convenience issue. It's really a social justice issue, as she describes it. Anyway, 6 months later, construction on the metro resumes, and she's kind of not willing to take credit, but there, the timeline suggests that it just needed this push, and so with the smallest intervention, one afternoon of putting up stickers, the actual thing, they've committed to building the first two lines. I mean, dozens of kilometres of track and multiple stations. So I'm using this as the example of large scale, partly because it's the most small scale on the one hand, but it also has the biggest effect. So it's another strategy which has incredible heavy infrastructural implications, but is achieved in such a strategic way. This is my final example, and it's a new one I've added to the deck, which I was introduced to yesterday. I'm calling it long term, even though it's more like medium term. I don't have a grand plan or a grand lecture on this one. I don't even know this guy's name. He showed us this picture. This is the day he acquired this site. It's on what Paul described as a kind of 2 out of 10 conflict level interface. I don't even know what part of the city it's in. I was just really impressed with his resolve and commitment to an idea. This is his cafe, which he's built out of shipping containers. He designed it himself. It's got one glass wall with a door at one end, shutters which can be folded over to defend it at night. He describes his sort of occupation as arriving every morning at 7 a.m., leaving at 7 p.m., erasing the graffiti that gets put on the thing, picking up the rubbish and just being there, just being in this very provocative centre of conflict, and just kind of, here he is, just kind of wonderfully diffuses this corner which it still sort of rattles with tension. My point is, and the reason he's long term is that this is kind of is familiar to architects. This looks like a pop-up. This looks like a groovy shoe store that we put down in the docks for the weekend, or a summer market or something fun. He's been there for 3 years, every day, just doing it. He's not looking for any pat on the shoulder. And I think just by being there, it's somehow important and architectural, and I was really inspired by his kind of attitude. So, in conclusion, make no little plans. We've gone full circle with Burnham. Ambition, but informed by different attitudes, different people, different contexts. And I've got two quotes to really finish with. This is Bruce Mau from the interview I did with him. Again, a sort of outsider looking in. If you think about architecture as a methodology, independent of the outcome, as agnostic from its product, you would see that architecture has deep culture of synthesis informed by civic values. If you have that capacity, that's the most valuable capacity of Islamic history. And finally, Wouter van Stiphout again, if an architect is humble, then what good are they? Thank you.
Any questions?
We also have books for sale. Yes.
The one thing I think that's missing off your list, Rory, is the architect's pedagogue.
Uh-huh.
Because I think that in the end, that's where they're most effective.
It's in the book.
Is it?
Right. There's a couple of examples. No,
yeah.
It's but it's.
And I don't mean teaching students of architecture, by the way. I mean within a societal.
Yeah. No, well that's true.
Okay, well then tell us some examples of those people.
Well, the example I have is Mel Dodd, who was a part of MUF and has since moved to Australia, and. I mean, you would probably know more about her work than I do, but it seems to me is a really great example of somebody from within an institution who's looking outward and involving students in life projects in difficult scenarios and getting out of this bubble of renderings and generative forms, you know. So some of her interventions are very small. She did a project called the name of the city, and it was just a bench, and it was a kind of terrain map of their territory, and then they just hung out there for a while and used it as a way to engage people in a difficult part of town. It sounds kind of, you know, low scale, and I'm telling the story terribly. but there's some interesting. I think it's an interesting precedent for an educator to be taking students out of their comfort zones. You know, in my experience, architects are most comfortable when they've been told what to do. They've been given the job, and they get to click away on AutoCAD and that incredible, exhilarating sense of power you have over this black background and white lines. You know, there's nothing. That's the kind of ultimate space of thinking, and I think she rejects that, not in the sense that you need to hand draw, but in the sense that you actually need to go and stomp around and talk to people, which is shouldn't be radical, but it somehow is.
Sorry, how do you think this manifests in the school of architecture in general? Because I don't know, for me, having been in different schools, I've very rarely seen any of these, the list that you have, actually have an impact on how, especially in higher levels, I guess, where there's a lot of emphasis on design as something to make things and not just design as related to other disciplines of the world, the real world.
Yeah. Again, I wouldn't set them up as a choice, as we need to leave design behind or this very crafted thing. I would hope that that's I mean, the power of that stuff is that it's so permanent, and if it's embodied with this kind of deeper knowledge, then it can make such a permanent impact. So I think it's, you know, the examples I showed today are not sort of the capital A architecture or real buildings in that sense, but hopefully they sort of spark off ideas and that can be channeled into this kind of thinking. And I think, you know, students are... they want to do that. I mean, the strange contradiction or irony of architectural education is that we're filled with this, you know, social ambition, or the, you know, it's a real that we're kind of public servants in the broadest, most generous sense. But the reality of practice is so different. The reality of practice is your first job out of school is documenting toilet blocks, or, you know, office suspended ceiling. I mean, that's the kind of bread and butter of the reality. And I think that, yeah, again, it doesn't need to be this binary, that the one thing can be informed by the other. Yeah. But we need to remain naive and, you know, visionary.
What would you say, or what's your comment on some architects' ideas of the future is, if you like, just to pedal faster and to do what we do as architects traditionally, just do it even better, and that will solve and do it cheaper. Yeah, is that the answer, or one of the answers, do you think?
Definitely not. I know. I feel like that we hit a strange fork in the road. I'm not sure when it happened. It was probably hundreds of years ago when we decided that the architect wasn't a kind of social strategist, but they were somebody really good at building or really good at managing that the process of the quality of light or of quality of materials or, you know, the stuff of architecture. And I think, yeah, like I said, that needs to be part of it. And perhaps this pedaling faster, what you're talking about is to get better at that, you know, better at light, better at materials, better at making things cheaper. And I think our obsession with you know, prefabrication or with, you know, parametrics or with, you know, sustainable evaluation is all part of that better, which we need to do, of course. Not at the expense of the other fork in the road, which might be about, you know, social knowledge or these other five points. So I think it's not one or the other, like we were saying before. It's not, abandon the base in search of new territory, but it's also not just defend the walls tighter from the outside, because I think we'll just starve. We need to kind of look to the distance and incorporate new things while staying true to the core, which is making really good building.
So, I had one other question. I think one of your early slides was architecture has lost its relevance. So if you were to put one slide at the end of your presentation, how to summarize, if you like, how to, for architecture and architects to become more relevant, what would you say?
Yeah, it would have to be this slide. Well, it's this one, I think.
Yeah.
And there's probably a dozen more, and they change for every project, but it's more a sense of, yeah, I believe in this expanded range of knowledge, and some, in fact, at one of the other launches that I did, Vasav and Stipan, who I keep coming back to, called the transdisciplinary, or this ambition to be professional generalists, as another form of marginalization that perhaps we lose our core by doing that, or that there's a cost to that. And yeah, I haven't quite reconciled that. I would come back to this Buckminster Fuller quote of the architect as a, you know, evolutionary strategist, economist, engineer, all these things. And of course, only Fuller could accommodate all the, that knowledge in one massive brain. But instead, we need to build diverse teams which are capable of fulfilling those roles. Yeah.
It's a very kind of global presentation that you gave, you know, that image you have of the Australian gentleman who died in 1971. What's his name?
Robin Boyd.
And he had that international network even then, and this is clearly a very internationally networked, probably, I would imagine, group of people. But have you kind of thought about how they deal with the localized resistance to these kinds of strategies? I'm kind of thinking about it in terms of Paul's PhD, but...
Yeah.
How do they kind of chip away at local resistance to acting as an architect in these ways, whether from their peers, you know, saying, no, you can't do that, or other forms of resistance that have happened to them locally? Have you looked at any of that or analyzed that?
I mean, the conversation we had last night, which was with Paul and a number of other architects based here, I definitely got that flavour, you know. And I think, I mean, I raised this idea of the ninja, this one thing that you can change that has such a big effect, you know. So if you're, when you run up against that wall, you know, which in the examples of last night was, well, they didn't, you know, accept this research that we'd done before as part of the tender package, which meant that it wasn't accepted and that none of that knowledge was carried on to the project, and, you know, it's because of their rules. And, well, you know, perhaps that thing you need to do is just zoom in and change that rule and open that door for the next person or whoever it is. I mean, the great example I use of this is... this guy called John Wardle, who is a faceless bureaucrat in Sydney. And I only heard about him because Marcus Westbury, the Newcastle guy, created a day called By John Wardle, a Beard Day. And the story goes, John Wardle's from Melbourne. He really liked live music and small bars. Went to Sydney, and all they have are these four-story mega club monstrosities. And he's like, what is the meaning of this? You know, why would anybody want to go to these places? Why isn't there a nice corner speakeasy? And looked into it as a you know, government employee that he is, worked in planning, and discovered that the cost of a alcohol permit or a liquor license in Sydney is, you know, a factor of 10 more than it is in Melbourne, and that it just was too, it just excluded these smaller tenants from being able to enter that territory. So in his, you know, little way, zoomed in there, changed that value, the whole process remains the same, it just lowered the cost, and in a number of years, like not even 3 years, the whole landscape of Sydney's drinking bar culture has changed. There's practically a bar on every corner. It's just become this explosion of, you know, there was this latent desire. And it's not just about, oh, great, there's more booze. It's actually solved some other social problems. Like when these superclubs would close at 3 o'clock, there would be marauding hordes of drunken louts up and down the streets. But now you have this much more fine grain pattern, and it's kind of, it's dealt with drunkenness and crime and a whole lot of other bigger issues. So again, when you're faced with that, you know, brick wall, I think the challenge is to not look at it from the top as the wall, but to find that little thing that's the little roadblock and try and unlock it. And if we all can do one or two of those in our lifetimes, then the whole place will be open. Paul.
This came up in discussion last night as well, but what struck me across all your examples were the diversity of platforms on which architects were operating. And I know that your own to operate in different ways and different platforms, whether it be broadcasting on one hand or architectural journalism on the other. I was wondering if you want to say a few more words about that ability to jump platforms, a bit like Robin Boyd's house, different levels. How will architects potentially do that? Does an architect move between radio and construction drawings on the other hand?
Yeah, I don't know. It's good to just talk about radio, because that's the kind of the other ones are fairly, you know, conventional. Lots of architects I know will write or will, you know, do big projects. I mean, we're quite flexible in that sense. One of the things I'm really proud of having worked on and having helped set up is a radio show in Australia called The Architects, and it's weekly. It's been going for 8 years. We've done 400 one-hour slots, so that's 400 interviews with local architects, people from overseas, people coming through, people from the government, people from planning, anybody kind of associated with architecture or design or urbanism or landscape. And what that did, you know, the first 2 years nobody listened, because we're on a community station, but it's sort of 7 o'clock at night, or you haven't found that rhythm. And then something weird started to happen, where this really fractured, combative place of Melbourne within architecture and within the broader conversation of the city. I don't know, somehow we managed to provide a reference point or some sort of common space where people can come and, you know, in the most generous way, describe what they do or what they're interested in, and kind of created this archive of voices or perspectives, which I think is really hopeful, and I believe it's changed the conversation, and it's one of those platforms which is, it just focuses on the ideas and the people because you ignore the visual, and for us, I think, yeah, being part of that radio station and what it's led to has, I think that shows the real power of, you know, thinking outside of the established mediums. You know, I would say what we've done is architecture. You know, we've changed a culture around design in a small way, and I would say that's a sort of architectural outcome.
By the same, I think it's a really fascinating approach, but perhaps with the rise of YouTube, where the visual is in conjunction with the spoken word, whether that's another platform, and perhaps it is one that's being explored by other architects, how you make, perhaps addressing what Sarah's asking about, how you address local resistance, is that something that may be a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that really that I see with the internet is it's memory. You know, it's a kind of embodied memory. And one of the projects I'm working on at the moment, which is with the Helsinki Design Lab, which is Citra. It's a kind of in-house strategic design unit in the Finnish government. And they've been working on a project called Brickstarter, which is a sort of Kickstarter, like a crowdfunding for bricks, so for public projects, space in public projects, in public space. And what's interesting is that it raises all these issues like, you know, who are the stakeholders, who agrees with this, who's going to fund it, who's going to, you know, who from council supports it. And now I forgot where I was going with that.
Democracy. You were saying that radio was divorced at the image system.
Oh, local issues. Yeah. So the other really great thing about this project is that for instance, one of the examples that they've been looking at is a food van, right? So Helsinki didn't have any laws which applied to a food van. And this guy got this great old VW wagon and wanted to sell pancakes on the square, you know, and had been putting together this business idea for a few years. Had just been stonewalled by the council. They didn't know what to do with this application. Is it a restaurant, or is it a piece of public furniture, or is it a vehicle? You know, it just didn't fit into their bureaucratic logic. And what they've been doing with this guy is to kind of map his process. So who did you end up having to speak to? What applications did you need to get? Where did you need to file it? How long did it take? And then to document that online. So if somebody else wants to do a food ban, they can now see the, you know, circuitous path through the what they call dark matter of bureaucracy. it's dark matter because, you know, the matter is the thing you see, and then the dark matter is not necessarily bad, it's just the thing that you can't see which allows it to exist. You know, it's the positive and negative thing. I think it's a great term for bureaucracy. It's this kind of invisible machinery which is so useful and frustrating at the same time, elusive. It's not quite YouTube, but it's the cultural, or it's the, you know, digital memory of the internet applied to this idea of, you know, the flaming hoops of bureaucracy can hopefully make it easier for the next guy who wants to start a coffee van or a whatever van, you know. And if we can assemble a series of these maps, then, you know, perhaps that process becomes more accessible to people. I mean, the theme underlying this is that, you know, currently the city is only accessible, or to manipulate the city is only accessible by those with capital, you know, the money to burn on lawyers to do that work for them, or to for architects to provide a proposal which can then be formally, you know, applied. But if you've got an idea, or you see an opportunity or a wasted space, then, you know, the balance should be tipped in your favour a little more than it currently is. And that's what their project is trying to correct. So one way of doing that is to at least try and make it transparent. Yeah.
Sounds like a PhD to me.
There you go. absolutely. And that comes back to that Bruce Mau quote, you know, just if architects have these skills, if you abstract it from the actual thing we produce, then, you know, just imagine where it could be applied. Yeah. So the fact that it's three architects working within government have you know, developed these ideas, I don't think is any coincidence. Not to say other designers or other, you know, creatives couldn't do the same, but I think we are well placed as synthesis. Yeah.
Are there any more questions, or should we go here?
I'm going to ask something more personal. You're based in Amsterdam, and I see that native speakers rarely leave the comfort zone of English-speaking countries. If they move to the UK or the state you chose, the Netherlands, and which can be quite challenging. It's probably not for the pod, so can you explain?
I can't speak Dutch. That's the first thing. But it's one of the great open secrets of Holland that they have an incredible grasp of English and a generosity with people who can't speak the native tongue. So I've probably outstayed my welcome after 4 years of not being able to speak the language, which is partly why I'm leaving, I think. The choice was easier to leave than to dig in and learn. Probably better for the pub, but all my family went to the UK. My family there, and my brother and my sister lived there, and my other brother, and I just wanted to go away from Australia, which everybody kind of has to do. It's our room springer. But not to England. And I have a British passport, so I can't go to America. So it's kind of like, well, I'll go to Holland. And architecture is, you know, good spot for that. Yeah.
One, a development of that question would be, having done all this study, where do you see yourself in 10 years' time?
Oh, that's the tricky one, isn't it? In a way, this is exactly. It's a kind of elaborate personal career exploration. I think I made myself more confused having done this than I was before I began. You know, I've got 17 options now on my plate.
Well, which one's the most attractive to you?
No, I think the answer, the sort of slippery answer to wriggle out of it is to say it's not one, but it is actually all of them, and you need to choose your strategy based on a project. So you don't say, I mean, well, and to be frank, I think strategy, which is one of these words, actually kind of encompasses them all in a way. So I think architect as strategist or strategic designer is one that fits for me. And then, yeah, underneath that, we need to apply all these other fields of knowledge on a sort of project basis.
Okay, can we
show
you? Thank you.